Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a couple of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Robert Reich, who was the Secretary of Labor under President Clinton. He is currently a Professor of Social and Economic Policy at Brandeis University. And we'll be talking to Robert Reich about the presidential debates, both the one that was a couple of days ago and the one that's coming up on Wednesday, which will be largely about domestic matters. And we'll be talking in general about this historical and critical election and explore why there appears to be a disconnect between the pundits, the chattering class, and the American people. We'll also speak with Lou DeBose, who's the author of a just published The Hammer, Tom DeLay, God, Money, and the Rise of the Republican Congress. Lou DeBose is formerly the editor of the Texas Observer, and he's the co-author with Molly Ivins of Bushwhacked: Life in George W. Bush's America. We'll be talking to him about Tom DeLay, who was twice censured in the last couple of weeks by the House Ethics Committee, and given his control over the House, he's a slash-and-burn, take-no-prisoners ideologue who appears to have intimidated the House and excluded Democrats from all conferences and relevance, yet he's managed to find himself censured. So obviously there's possibly more. It could be. He got off lightly, in other words. Then we'll speak with Michelle Krauss, the CEO of Digital Campaigns, a company that's exploring and developing new technologies to be employed in vote counting and exit polling so that we can have accurate, foolproof, and transparent voting in this country. And the technology is available. We look into reasons why it's not being employed. I'm speaking with Robert Reich, who's the former Secretary of Labor under the Clinton administration. He's currently a professor of social and economic policy at Brandeis University. And Robert Reich, it seems that the two debates that I've seen, and the third one, of course, is coming up on Wednesday, if you look at the debates and then you turn to the punditry afterwards, if, for example, you hadn't seen the debates and listened to the punditry, you might as well be on another planet. I mean, there seems to be a fundamental disconnect between the punditry and the debates. Do you share that?
Well, I share that view, Ian, to some extent. I don't listen to the punditry. I basically turn the debates, turn the television off after the debate. So I'm not terribly well situated to make any definitive views or express any definitive views about it. But it seemed to me very clearly that in both debates, John Kerry was the more poised, the more articulate, and the more presidential. And I think most Americans seem to have agreed with that position.
Well, and also, in contrast to John Kerry, it seems in both debates that President Bush had a kind of peeved and petulant attitude, that he was almost felt like, I shouldn't even be there in the first place. Why am I listening to this guy? And it seems to me that was one of the rare occasions when this president who is cloistered, protected, and has the most secretive administration in probably in American history, isn't used to anybody saying anything that's critical or even confrontational. And the distinct impression I got was that if you look at this as a job interview, you've got two candidates before you and you are conducting a job interview, one of them seemed to be on top of things and the other one was kind of irritable and amped up.
Ian, this is an administration that has carefully controlled the press and access to the press. And I think that the price that this administration pays for that control is that the president is not prepared to deal directly, visibly, publicly with criticism. So that when John Kerry criticizes him, when he confronts unfriendly questions, he does go into a kind of defensive and angry mode. His shoulders get hunched. He starts ranting and yelling a little bit. To me, that was not terribly effective in terms of persuading voters that he is a dignified and capable president. So I think it hurt him ultimately. You know, Ian, when it comes time election day for people to vote, the real issue is going to be how many are motivated to go to the polls. The polls themselves, I'm talking about opinion polls, don't really mean much. The voting polls and people who actually go out and vote, that's the true test. My suspicion, based on a kind of free-floating focus group that I've conducted across this country and also polls that I've seen, is that the primary and strongest motivation continues to be anti-Bush. Most people who are going to the polls, who are highly motivated, are going to go there because they dislike the policies of this administration. That anti-Bush sentiment, if anything, seems to be growing, not shrinking.
Well, it's interesting that touch on the punditry again, after the debates, Tim Russert, who is one of the top pundits, if you will, he was commenting on the quality of the questions from the ordinary citizens that were there in that debate that we saw on Friday. And they were carefully screened, and questions were equally apportioned to both Democrats and Republicans. And what was interesting, apart from the fact that the questions were very incisive and quite pungent, the interesting thing to me was that if half of those questions were from Republicans, they certainly weren't giving President Bush any breaks. So that might indicate that there are a lot of Republicans out there who are not happy with their president.
Well, it's possible, although Kerry also got some hard questions. I think that the purpose of that debate was to enable people who were there representing average citizens to ask difficult, not tricky questions, but difficult questions of both candidates. My impression, again, is that the debate format is a wonderful way in which people watching, and there were 50, 60 million people watching the first debate, I think almost as many on last Friday, they give an opportunity for people to listen and watch, not just in terms of what these candidates say, but how they say them and how they conduct themselves. Television that has so many other limitations in so many ways, and I'm not a fan of the medium, but in this particular instance, it does and has given voters an insight into both of these potential presidents for the second beginning on January 20th, that they wouldn't otherwise have. I think John Kerry comes off in ways that are very, very positive and surprisingly positive to many voters who just didn't know him.
So in other words, you think that these hundreds of millions of dollars that they've spent attacking each other has come to naught, that most people make up their minds based on these debates?
Well, the debates, at least this time around, are having, I think, a major influence. It's not just the debates themselves. It's also the conversations that people have with their friends and relations after the debates. Over this weekend, for example, I can't tell you how many people I've either overheard, just informally around little restaurants and every place else, and also conversations I've had where people are talking about the debates. They're weighing and balancing, and they're assessing the candidates based on that. That's happening all weekend across America. So there's a multiplier effect, not just the 50 million people or so who watched, but also another several, 10, 15, 20 million who may have missed it, but who are nevertheless interested. We may see record levels of voter turnout this time around, at least relative to the last several presidential elections, because people know it's very tight. And the stakes are very high, and the debates have actually stimulated them to become even more invested and more interested.
And we also may be in for a surprise, because all of the punditry and the polling is based upon likely voters and registered voters, and we don't really know how many new voters are coming to the system, but there is an indication that there is a groundswell of registration, particularly amongst single mothers and Gen Y young women, who the proponents of whom would vote Democrat. So I would think that in spite of some of the pessimism that has been around on the Democratic side, and I think that serves the interests of Karl Rove and others. I mean, isn't that the ultimate Republican strategy, to discourage people on the other side? Isn't that what they do?
Ian, I think that is the strategy, that has been the strategy. And 2 weeks ago, let's face it, a lot of Democrats were very discouraged. Kerry seemed to be sinking in the polls. The Swift boat accusations, even though there was absolutely nothing to them, proven to be completely false, they were and had taken a toll. But Kerry has bounced back. The race is not only even, but the Associated Press poll released yesterday showed Kerry in the lead. Democrats are now very encouraged. 3 weeks before an election, a little bit more than 3 weeks, what you want is momentum. That's the classic word now going into the final stretch of an election. Bush does not have it. Kerry does.
But in the most optimistic poll for John Kerry, which is the Zogby poll, it's still the percentage that Kerry's ahead is taken care of by the nadir factor, which is, you know, ranging between 2 and 3%. So that's still, if you count nadir in, then Kerry's behind.
Well, we can debate different polls, but I think what you said a moment ago is absolutely the case. Regardless of how close the race is right now, those polls matter very little. They do not register, they do not account for new voters who are just registered, and they also don't account for, and they don't measure, they can't possibly measure, who is actually going to be sufficiently motivated to go and vote on Election Day. And there is where I think momentum counts the most. So I'm cautiously optimistic. Again, one cannot be optimistic. I mean, this is we saw what happened in Florida in the year 2000. There are a lot of rumors floating around about this or that set of voting machines being fixed. I'm taking nothing for granted. But from the standpoint of being a Democrat who is concerned about social justice and the values that really I think a lot of other Americans hold dear and want a world based upon international law rather than just might, I think that things are looking up.
Now, if you're optimistic about the Democrats' chances, how then do you feel about the nadir factor? If he still has the ability, at least theoretically, according to the polls, to swing the election to Bush?
Well, 3% is important, obviously, in a very close election, and we saw what happened in the year 2000. I find it hard to understand why somebody, having lived through the year 2000, seeing what the nadir vote did, why somebody who is in favor, basically, of progressive values and a progressive administration, certainly in favor of getting rid of George Bush's administration, would nevertheless vote for nadir. I don't want to tell anybody what to do, obviously. It's up to them. Look, let's put it quite frankly and candidly. Ralph Nader was a friend of mine. I like to think that he still is. I haven't talked to him in a while. I admired him greatly in the 1960s and 1970s. But with regard to this particular race and continuing it on now, especially after we learned what we did about his effect on the 2000 race, I think that he is exercising, in my view, this is my private view, a lot of irresponsibility and even narcissism.
And in terms of the Kerry campaign, and of course, I think the nadir people will say, "Well, Gore lost it. He was responsible for his own loss." And they will probably, if they are the factor that defeats Kerry and gets Bush back in for four more years, they will say that it's because Kerry didn't run a good campaign. The one thing that I must say that's mystified me about the Kerry campaign throughout this entire election season has been that the biggest issue upon which George W. Bush is vulnerable is this ridiculously unnecessary, humiliating, gaping wound that he's inflicted on the American people by going to war and putting the United States in a war that they, for all intents and purposes, have lost. And I understand that it's not John Kerry's position to accept defeat for George Bush's war. Bush should accept defeat for his own mistakes. However, the fact that they've only started to talk about it in the last couple of weeks, and now you can see from the first two debates that it's really the centerpiece of this election. So why is it there's this lag in the consciousness of the American people about how badly off we are in Iraq and what a monstrous mistake it is that this president has put this country in? His mistake has become our problem.
Well, Ian, I think, first of all, the press, and I'm not talking about the right-wing press, I'm talking about the establishment press, was very slow to pick up on the extent of this mistake, even so far as to have the New York Times admonish itself publicly in its pages for not being critical enough at the early stages of Bush's war. And I think now, when we see the casualties mount and we see ourselves getting bogged down and anti-Americanism around the world rise, And terrorism, particularly terrorism that may have something to do with al-Qaeda, not deterred whatsoever, al-Qaeda continuing to do whatever al-Qaeda is doing, I think people are beginning to scratch their heads. Even conservative Americans are beginning to scratch their heads and say, now, wait a minute, something fundamental is wrong here. There were no weapons of mass destruction. There's no evidence at all linking Saddam Hussein with Osama bin Laden. Even Republicans, people who are very outspoken and were very outspoken about the war, have now come around in the last month to say this was a colossal mistake. You're right. Americans have been slow to catch on. The media was slow to catch on. John Kerry did not make it the centerpiece of his campaign until recently. But George Bush decided early on that he was going to campaign as the war president. He decided that it was going to be the centerpiece of this election. Democrats were worried about that. Democrats wanted to really turn the election on the economy, on jobs, on wages, on things that are also going very, very badly right now. But nonetheless, the war is front and center. And George Bush, I think, is going to have to pay a penalty for that.
And, but how does Senator Kerry navigate this? Because there was one moment, several moments actually in the debate, where President Bush repeated this same assertion that we're better off without Saddam, and in the question about why the links between Saddam and al-Qaeda have proven to be not there, he nevertheless keeps repeating that his job is to prevent dictators like Saddam Hussein from getting nuclear weapons, which they will then in turn hand over to al-Qaeda. Well, you wish that somebody would have said, wait a minute, we just found out from a second, the Iraqi survey group that spent close to $1 billion scouring that country, that there are no weapons of mass destruction, and the 9/11 Commission has determined that there's no connection between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. So the bottom line is Saddam Hussein doesn't have nuclear weapons, so you cannot hand over non-existent nuclear weapons to a terrorist.
Even Bush's own people, the people that Bush put in place to scout for nuclear weapons, the people Bush put in place to be intelligence czars on this issue, have come back and said this is a failure. There was nothing there. There's nothing to it. And also, if our job is to simply get rid of dictators who are bad people, Lord knows there are many other places around the world where we could have done our work as effectively, if not more effectively. There's no end, it seems, to these bad people. But if we are particularly concerned about avoiding another 9/11, this seems to have been a frolic and detour. And now, here again, Ian, I think it's very important that people pay attention to the fact that Bush just says the same thing over and over again. His debating style is one of simply assertion. No arguments, but just assertion, with a lot of petulance behind the assertion. I don't think Americans buy it, frankly. Now, we have people like Tony Blair, who is the head of a nation where most people are against the war, who uses the same style of just assertiveness. He is much more articulate than George Bush. He sees the deposition of Saddam Hussein as something of a moral triumph. And I think it's too bad that Tony Blair is taking that and providing legitimacy toward George Bush. But everywhere else in the world, this just looks like what it is, which is a terrible, terrible tragedy at a cost of over 1,000 American lives, countless Iraqi lives, the lives of many, many others, and hundreds of billions of dollars.
Well, I think in a nutshell, George Bush's argument is have faith. I have faith. You know, my gut check is right. Therefore, you should have faith, but you know, don't ask me details. It's an extraordinarily hubristic attitude given the results on the ground. I mean, this is the part that I don't understand. You've got gas prices at the all-time record. You've got debt for generations, mounting like something like a nightmare out of The Sorcerer's Apprentice. And you've got this sucking wound, this endless humiliation that the United States is going through internationally, where every day that goes by, the hole gets dug deeper in Iraq and there doesn't seem to be any way out. So, you know, you'd think you could run a Cocker Spaniel against this guy and beat him.
Well, don't underestimate the power of the Republican machine, the lie machine. the deceptive machine is extraordinarily well-developed. Right-wing radio in this country, as you know, is spreading a lot of lies and distortions, has been doing for years, but with greater and greater vehemence, and the multiplication of the right-wing talk show format is something that has really deluded and distorted a lot of Americans in terms of their views of what's going on. Right-wing television is also, Fox News has become basically a Republican mouthpiece. So it's very hard for a lot of people to sift through. Even though George Bush is saying nothing, except just simple assertion, and even though the evidence is collapsing around him, and even though other issues like the economy showing 96 million new jobs, 96,000 new jobs rather, last Friday for the entire month of September, you need 150,000 new jobs just to keep up with the expansion of the labor force. I mean, this is the worst economy we've had in 70 years in terms of job creation, and yet the Republican spin machine, the distortion machine, has been quite effective in persuading almost half of the population of the United States that things are actually going quite well domestically and internationally. They are, in my view, a very dangerous crowd because of their Orwellian capacity to repeat the big lie over and over until many people begin to think that there might be something to it.
Well, just in closing, then, it's clear that President Bush, I thought, was petulant, defensive, and over-amped to the point where he was sort of almost like an electrified rooster, sort of, you know. There was nothing natural. The pundit said he was forceful and strong.
I thought he
was sort of a little bit off the wall, but...
I think that...
But the point is, though, he did nail Kerry on one thing, I thought, and that was that when he said that, how can you get people to come in and help you in Iraq, clean up the mess, didn't say that, but help you, if you say it's the wrong war at the wrong time. So,
well, you see, Kerry at that time could have said, and I've heard him say, just as you almost said just then, it was the wrong war. It is the wrong war at the wrong time in the wrong place, but we now have a mess on our hands, and the stability of the entire Middle East depends on cleaning up the mess. It's too bad there is a mess. It's a great tragedy that George Bush created the mess, but we've got to have help getting the mess cleaned up, and John Kerry now have the credibility that George Bush doesn't have to go to other major traditional allies of the United States and say, look, we all have an interest in clearing up this awful situation.
So just a quick look forward to Friday, to Wednesday. What do you think? We know it's about domestic issues. You'd think that Kerry would be able to win this one hands down, given the state of the economy and the cost of health care and the general disaster that this president has brought upon the country. In terms of, I mean, he is literally, doesn't govern. He just transacts from people who give him, he raises money, campaign money for, and then he gives, you know, these corporate goodies to them.
Exactly, and I think that Kerry will be making that point, and Kerry is going to be on very firm ground. I suspect that he will, as he has the first two debates, win the third debate. But more importantly, I think people are becoming more comfortable with John Kerry and the idea of John Kerry as president, as a viable alternative to somebody who, in the terms of named George Bush, who they are very increasingly uncomfortable with. You see, the voters have got to make two decisions here, wrapped up in one. The first decision is that George Bush is no longer capable of leading the nation in a direction where the nation wants to go on foreign and domestic policy. The second decision is that John Kerry is. That is, people are willing to stick with a president that may not be exactly what they wanted if they are worried about the alternative, if they are confused about the alternative, if they think the alternative really may be worse. And what the Bush administration had done up until just the first debate, through swift boat advertising and all the rest, and the accusations of flip-flopping, is to create so much damage to John Kerry's reputation, before John Kerry had even established a reputation with the American people, that a lot of people were worried that even though they don't like George Bush, they may be getting into something worse. Well, I think that's gone now. John Kerry, through these debates, has established in the public's mind that he is presidential, that he can do the job. And therefore, again, with cautious optimism, I think he's going to not only win the third debate, but also, if we can get the turnout we need, go on to win the election.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Robert Reich.
Thanks very much, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Robert Reich, who's the former Secretary of Labor under President Clinton. He's currently a professor of social and economic policy at Brandeis University. I'm now speaking with Luda Bose, the author of the just-published The Hammer, Tom DeLay, God, Money, and the Rise of the Republican Congress. And Luda Bose is the editor of the Texas Observer, and he's also co-author with Molly Ivanzov, Bushwhacked, Life in George W. Bush's America. And the last couple of weeks have not been good weeks for Tom DeLay, and he's been censured twice by the House Ethics Committee on two separate issues. First one being that he, in order to muscle a recalcitrant Republican, fiscally responsible Republican, into going for the Medicare giveaway bill that they were lying about the cost of at the time, and we've subsequently found out that it's costing considerably more than it was advertised. He promised this Republican congressman that he would support his son in a forthcoming election. And then the second censure just this week was about his activities with an energy company. And you've written about some people down in Texas who have given money to DeLay. And it seems that the way he's operating here is that the people he raises money from, he kind of hangs them out to dry.
He does when the time comes, Ian. He's been known to cut and run. Once he's got the check and there's a problem, in the case that you have referred to here in Texas, he has managed to get eight corporations indicted for contributing money to his PAC. And he says, he maintains that he has had nothing to do with it. It's not about me. It is, however, about him. It's about three. The Travis County District Attorney has indicted three of Tom DeLay's top fundraising aides, from whom he is quickly distancing himself. And eight corporations who gave corporate money in an election to Texas, and you don't even have to use the standard journalistic ass covering of allegedly they gave corporate money to election campaigns in Texas, and it's illegal to spend or to donate corporate money to elections in Texas. Tom DeLay walked so far, but my bet is that ultimately he does a perp walk here.
Well, how is it then that that a man that has this tremendous control over the Congress. I mean, he's got this sort of slash and burn, take no prisoners attitude. He's largely been the lightning rod for this polarization and this enmity between the Republicans and the Democrats. The Democrats are essentially shut out of conference, so they don't know what's going on. They're kind of political eunuchs in Tom DeLay's house. They only find out about what they're voting on a few hours before, when they get an 800-page bill with Christmas ornaments all over it that have been put on during these private Republican conference committees between the Republican House and the Senate, from which the Democrats are excluded. And the very fact that he could even be censured, given the way he's intimidated his own people, would indicate to me that he got off easy.
He got off easy, and he's in big trouble. By the way, the bill that you refer to was 1,200 pages long, and that was a bit of an embarrassment. So they decreased the type size and did a second print run because of the Democrats were complaining that the bill was 1,200 pages long, and they said, no, it's not. It's not 8 or 9. The Ethics Committee did probably as much as it could. The Ethics Committee, the House Ethics Committee, is pretty much moribund. It hasn't done anything in 7 years, except notably two acts of censure against Tom DeLay back to back in 2 weeks. There's a truce between Democrats and Republicans on the Ethics Committee, so you don't shoot at us and we don't shoot at you. And there is a new rule on the Ethics Committee since 1997. That no outside party can file a complaint. So it's a closed system. So when the Ethics Committee acts, it's a big deal. Even though it acted, even though it behaved rather timidly in this case, and when it acts, it is a big deal. Also, you know, bear in mind, this is not Tom DeLay's second or first or second. It's his third. In 1999, he was again reprimanded by the Ethics Committee for pulling a bill from the floor of the House, a bill that was the International Property Rights, Intellectual Property Rights Bill, immensely important piece of legislation to protect American companies from intellectual property rights theft. A conservative bill, a liberal bill, you know, just a business bill. He pulled it off the floor of the House because Electronics Trade Association hired a former Democrat as its chief lobbyist, and his threat was, we're going to stop the passage of this bill. He was censored. He was reprimanded for that. They sent him a private letter. No one had seen the letter except DeLay and the Ethics Committee members and their lawyers. He won't release it. But the entire House was warned never again to take a government action on behalf of or to punish a client for political purposes. So he's got three strikes against him now, and there's more to come.
But he, for example, this is a man who ran in his last campaign on the platform that the United States should be declare itself, we should have a constitutional amendment, declare this a Christian nation under the Lord Jesus as the head of state. So how do you reconcile his apparently, you know, it's not so much illegal, but, you know, pushing the envelope in terms of legality and his kind of thuggish approach to politics and the incredibly sort of, you know, I guess this maybe comes from having been in his professional life a pest exterminator, but it seems that this his attitude to the Democrats is that they're not worthy. They're almost evil in a way. So where is the Christian consistency here between the Tom DeLay's espoused views and his thuggish behavior?
Go figure. We do Jesus differently in Texas, I think. And maybe the message is, you know, beware of drunks who find Jesus and politics at the same time, like Tom DeLay and George Bush.
Both is he a former alcoholic?
He was here in Texas. You know, back when he was the Tom DeLay that we knew and loved in the Texas legislature, he was known as Hot Tub Tommy or Hot Tub Tom, depending on how close you were to him, and a lot of people were close. You know, he lived in a rent house that was known as Macho Manor with one former Democratic legislator and what I will call two unindicted co-conspirators in the ongoing investigation. You know, they had a great time. The Texas legislature is a big party, 180-day party every 2 years, and Tom DeLay was the life of the party. He went to Washington in 85, rode the second Reagan election wave in, and he got there, and he was drunk every night, he said, drinking 10 to 12 martinis a night, a staggering amount of alcohol, and even for a guy like Tom DeLay. And he walks into Frank Wolf's office, and Frank Wolf hands him a congressman from Virginia, hands him a videotape of James Dobson from Focus and the Family. And Tom DeLay finds Jesus right there in that office, stops drinking, and gets focused. And I think, in part, the stop drinking helped him, it cleared out his schedule in the evening so he could raise money and campaign. And he became a much more focused member of Congress. On the other hand, the Christian values are sometimes hard to find, but they're sometimes hard to find with George Bush too. There's a great deal of hypocrisy that goes on here. And
but what about the anger there? These are people that control the Congress and the presidency. And because you got another clone, a Christian clone, over there in the Senate with Bill Frist, so and Denny Hastert, everybody knows that's he's just a flunky of DeLay's, any rate. So these are both Bush and DeLay have tremendous power, and they're exercising it in ways that are extraordinarily aggressive, and yet they seem to be so angry. So what the hell are they angry about?
They're angry because they don't have absolute power, and they've almost got it now. They're angry when they're criticized by other members of Congress. As you mentioned, we found in reporting this book, talked to a number of Democrats, talked to some Republicans. Most Republicans will only talk off the record because this is like writing about a mafia don. But the Democrats are held power for 40 years, and that really there were some abuses. I mean, they were not. It wasn't like Boy Scout troop meetings, but they're angry. It was a sort of festering anger. But remember, in 1994, the Gingrich Revolution, it elected a bunch of angry white men, essentially angry white Christians who felt like they needed to wage a cultural war to restore this country's integrity and address important issues like public policy like homosexuality and abortion. There's a bunch of angry. The Congress is really run by a cabal of angry white men, and Tom DeLay is the angriest and the most powerful. He more than any one member of the Congress, far more than Newt, who Tom DeLay tried to take down prematurely in 1997, in a sort of palace coup that fell apart. Than Newt Gingrich. He brought those guys into power. He did it the modern way in the Congress of creating power. He raised $775,000 and spent it on probably 70 candidates. But then he admittedly, by his own admission, took $2 million from the lobby. And he would call lobbyists, or his aide Mildred Weber would call lobbyists and say, this guy needs X amount of dollars, this woman needs X amount of dollars. So he built this loyal base among the most radically conservative group of legislators ever elected to the United States Congress. And they're still loyal to him, and they're also afraid of him.
Well, just in closing, then, Lutobos, he is apparently vulnerable, though. I mean, remember the insurgents, Gingrich and DeLay, managed to knock off Tom Foley, who was the Democratic House Speaker. Is there a possibility that the Democrats can take this guy's seat? Because I understand the challenge is not too far behind him.
Yeah, I don't think they win the I don't think they win the Congress this time. I think
But what about his seat specifically down there in Fort Worth?
It's going to be a tough fight because of the way he's redrawn the state's districts. But I think the real threat to Tom DeLay now might be from within his own party. I mean, here you have a guy who is has three of his top aides indicted here in Texas, and there are more indictments to come, and he may very well be indicted. Here, you have. Two ethics committee reprimands in 2 weeks. You have two of his closest aides being investigated by John McCain, two of his closest associates, his former press aide, for bilking $66 million from six Indian tribes, one of them in the L.A. area, for almost doing nothing in lobbying fees. There's a federal grand jury investigating them, and John McCain is investigating them. And I think the question will arise sometime over the next session is how much accumulated scandal can one member of the leadership sustain before he collapses vertically. And Tom DeLay may very well collapse.
I thank you very much for joining us, Lou.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Lou DeBose, the author of the just-published The Hammer, Tom DeLay, God, Money, and the Rise of the Republican Congress. Now let's go to the issue of electronic voting, the disquiet about electronic machines, and also the possibility that there is there's technology both available and in the future that can make American voting transparent, honest, and accurate. I'm speaking with Michelle Krauss, who's the CEO of Digital Campaigns. And Michelle, following the 2000 elections in Florida, where originally the state was awarded to Al Gore based on exit polls, and exit polls, of course, measure the intent of the voter, not the execution, and then it turned out that a lot of people who thought they were voting for Gore, some voted for Buchanan, others were scrubbed from the lists, etc. We saw the whole kind of dismal third world display of how I think for the first time Americans realized how flawed their electoral system and their democracy is. What, in your opinion, has happened since then with all that money that's been allocated to improve the system?
Well, there have been a number of things that have done with all the money that has been raised this year. In particular,
I'm talking about the federal money, though.
The federal money. Are you talking about the money that came from the federal system?
In other words, the congressional response to the global embarrassment of the 2000 election.
Well, there has been a lot of safekeeping put in place. But there is so much more work to be done. I, in particular, believe that we need real-time poll checking at the polls at the time of the person voting. I believe that we need a system of checks and balances. I believe a good deal of, shall we call it, infrastructure has been put in place, but we have a long way to go, and this is only the very beginning.
So in other words, technology is available to solve these problems. So what explains the lag between the technology that you have and that you're promoting and the technologies being employed now in the form of electronic voting machines, which a large and growing section of the public has no confidence in?
Well, you know, Ian, if we use the kind of expertise that is used in the slot machines, the best of the best of breed of technology in terms of tabulations and the kind of digital records that are kept, our voting machines that are being used and deployed across the country would have a high degree of confidence. I think we still have a long way to go, and there are many proposals right now at the level of the Secretary of State and individual states to relook at the voting machine technology in particular and to propose other related kinds of systems that would include a paper trail, an audit trail, and a variety of other attributes. I think we're in the infancy of what it means to do electronic voting in this particular country, and it's very hard to compare us to other related countries like Venezuela, because Venezuela, what is it? It's the size of Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and New York. We're a very vast nation. We have an enormous populace to vote, and I think the challenge is to get standards and to build infrastructure that will sustain itself over time. And I believe that we're in the infancy. My company, Digital Campaigns, is involved in using wireless technology that allows for real-time checking as a person comes in to vote in the polls. We sat down with a series of experts from field operations. And field operations are the heart and soul of how you get out the vote, how you talk to people, how you target people, and how they get information. And we said to them, if there's anything in the world that you want, what is it? And this is what they wanted. And it's finally a point at which you can take advanced technology and use it in a very mundane way to take the business of something that is done today on paper and allow it to be more effective. And that's what we've done. And in particular in this election, we're very concerned with rural areas, and we have an opportunity because of the tremendous leadership of Senator Byron Dorgan, to be able to have these conversations. He's been committed to the implementation of broadband to people all across rural America and has really been the leader in this telecom policy, which is why I'm on the way to North Dakota to have these discussions. Does that help?
That helps, but let me ask you then about just if you can explain the notion of broadband and broadband access and what many call digital democracy. That is, just as my understanding is that when the telephone came in, there was the Rural Electrification Act where telephones and electricity was subsidized to reach rural communities. I believe that the same notion applies to broadband, that there should be broadband should be made accessible to everybody in the country, but in particularly in rural areas, and that is what you're promoting, plus you're suggesting that there is this broadband technology can also be applied to poll watching.
That's correct. Let's talk about rural America. I mean, I believe that every person, whether they be white, black, purple, orange, blue, whatever, should have the ability to have access to broadband, whether it's for access to the computer systems and the internet, or to be used in schools, or to be used in telecommunications, to be able to connect families. And I think regardless of their socioeconomic status or where they live or who they are, they deserve the right to have this access, period. Now, there is a commercial company that's been put together that is addressing the rural issues in partnership with Nextel, and this company is called Extend America. And they understand the challenges of putting advanced telecom networks across these areas in rural America, and they're beginning to start to do that. And because of our discussions, we're on our way to explore how this can be used. Because I believe whether you live in Mississippi or you live in rural Midwest, you have the right to have the connectivity and the democratization of information and access to it available to you.
But isn't the problem with broadband is that now the last mile, in other words, the cable's been laid. There's fiber optics all over the country.
That's correct.
The issue is the last mile to the home.
That's correct.
And the last mile is essentially being controlled by the big cable companies and by the telecommunications monopolies. There's about eight of them that control 80 to 90% of access. So that's the problem, isn't it? You're saying that the broadband ought to be a utility right, like the telephone is.
That's correct.
So where's the legislative impetus to take it out of the hands of these monopolies and make it a citizen's right to have broadband, as I believe there is legislation and been on the books for some time that allows people to have in rural areas to have telephones by that.
You know, the thing that's unique, and I'm sorry to interrupt, about the project we're looking at is the last mile actually becomes a non-issue because we're talking about wireless connectivity. We are talking about the use of wireless mechanisms to go the last mile. So you're outside the parameters of the bureaucracy that you're suggesting, and that's what truly is the innovation involved with this, because a wireless signal is a wireless signal. Now, the question is line of sight, and there's all sorts of complex technical issues, but you are absolutely correct about the other issue of the last mile into the home and the last mile into the school. I don't think that I can solve that today. I'm very humble in knowing my little bits that I can chew on, but I know that I can bring handheld wireless devices into rural America, and I can make sure that every person that comes into that poll is recorded.
So in other words,
I can make sure that happens in real time.
So in other words, what you have is a poll watcher with a BlackBerry, right? And then they just,
or a trio, depending upon what network they're on. Absolutely.
And then they just check off everybody that comes in.
That's correct.
And then so if you wanted to get the vote out, you'd find out whether people weren't voting.
That's correct.
But on the other hand, if you were like a neutral party, like they had the poll watching in the 2000 that was hired by press consortiums, they would also be able to do accurate exit polls. Because let's face it, there is no confidence out there in the country about the electronic voting machines. And there's one-third of people casting their votes in this forthcoming election will be casting them on these machines. So, and we don't have any knowledge or confidence at this point that there will be any exit polling. So there's absolutely no way to know the difference between the intention of the voter and the execution.
You know, Ian, I couldn't agree with you more at this moment in time. And we are in a real polemic of how we do assess this. I can tell you there are groups that are deploying lawyers into every single region, into every single precinct. I know that there will be more people on the ground than there have ever been before. Can I solve electronic voting? No, I can't. But can I add to it by giving additional information, and can I build that digital and data infrastructure for this country? Yes, I can. And that's my mission. Does that help?
Well, that helps, but I think that what you're up against here is that the very fact that technology that works and that gives the voter confidence and that can be employed to do recounts is available. It's just not being employed. There's a whole history in this country of voter suppression. If you look at the entire history going back to the Founding Fathers, they wanted to restrict the vote to white men of property only. It's always been a question of restricting the vote rather than making it easy. This is the only country that forces people to register and gives them deadlines, and if they can't register, they can't vote. The rest of the world has made it really simple. They, you know, you just have a voter register, you know, you register for life, and you show up and you vote anywhere. You don't have to vote at specific polling places. Most of the elections in the rest of the world are conducted on the weekends, so people aren't working. They've got 2 days to vote. There's absolutely, when you said Venezuela has a voting electronic machines that give you a receipt and are therefore and also can be recounted. This is the part of it that I don't understand it. So you've got the answers. Where's the resistance coming from?
You know, Ian, if I had a crystal ball, I would tell you. I can tell you that every issue that you have raised is something that is very near and dear to my heart. Okay? I understand it. But what I've learned in the experience of the 20 years that I've been trying to affect technology change is that there is resistance. There haven't been enough professional commercial operations interested in this. And this is where you'll get the brilliance that you need, which is my reference to the technologists that are working on slot machines, because you need the brilliance that commercial minds bring to this. And unfortunately, it hasn't been sexy, it hasn't been interesting until this moment in time. Okay? Mm-hmm. And now you're seeing companies that are getting funded and that are popping up and that have real funding to make this happen. We are in a point of major change. And I believe that over the next 4 years, regardless of what happens in this particular election, you will see monumental changes as more and more true professional technologists come into this field and say, wait a second, this is the right way to do it. This is part of the solution. And unfortunately, it hasn't been where the money's been made, and you know, you always follow the money. But you're going to see changes, and you're going to see more and more people like myself who have built their careers on running technology companies saying, wait a second, we need to take a look at this. There's opportunity here. I will predict that this will change over the next 4 years. I'm sorry it hasn't changed fast enough. I'm probably one of the most impatient people you know on the planet. But I'm trying desperately to take a step back, take a deep breath, and continue forward because I know we will impact the change.
Well, finally, Michelle, if you've got, you're saying there's a lot of new companies with new technology that are entering the field. The field is dominated by Diebold and ES&S, I believe, two companies. They've been the recipients of most of the federal money.
That's correct.
And this seems to be where the problem is. If the politicians who have an interest in the status quo are giving out the money, then you've got to find a way to get them to suddenly...
Get private funding, Ian. There's places to get the money. You've seen in the proliferation of 527 that it exploded out the gate in the last year that there is money here.
But what happens if you think people are going to go to a poll and say you're voting on a MoveOn.org machine or you're voting on a SwiftBoat machine? That's not going to work.
No. But I look toward a collaboration of some of the best minds saying, how do we build the right technology? How do we deploy the right technology? What's the right way to do this? And that's where, maybe I'm an optimist, because I always am. But I believe that change is in the wind. And I'm not saying we need a MoveOn.org or we need a SwiftBoat.org or whatever. I'm saying we need the best minds paying attention to this, mm-hmm. because they have not. They have been busy with their heads down with commercial operations. And now, for the first time, I know, because I live in the heart of Silicon Valley, I am watching these people question. I'm watching them raise their hand. I'm watching them say, wait a second. And I believe it's the responsibility of not some of the federal funding, but the individual secretaries of state that monitor voting and that regulate voting and that have availability to federal funds, mm-hmm. that they need to wake up, smell the roses, and begin to engage some of these groups that will do this. Maybe it will come out of California because of the brilliance of Silicon Valley. Maybe it'll come out of Massachusetts because of the brilliance of 128. But I can tell you, people are paying attention.
So just in closing then, Michelle, so if the citizens of this country demand 21st century voting and not to have this whole system that is so gamed by both parties and that there's so much interest in suppressing votes, that... You can't rely on the politicians, but the bottom line is the technology's there. That's infinitely better technology, and if there's more brains applied to it, it'll even get better. So it seems to me, just in closing, the obvious thing is that the public have just got to demand a better system. And
well, I think the public needs to get, let me be blunt, they need to get educated. They need to raise their voices. They need to get engaged. Okay? It's not good enough anymore that 22 million single women under the age of 30 never registered. It's called, it's not going to change unless you walk your talk, and the public has to get involved. Those 22 million need to come forward. They need to register. They need to be involved. They need to vote. And with this, there is a whole coalition of possibilities of what can be possible. And I know I'm tough on this stuff, but my ancestors were killed in their attempt to vote and or worship, and I'll be damned if I don't.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Michelle.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
It's coming to America first. The cradle of the best and of the worst. It's here they got the range and the machinery for change. And it's here they got the spiritual thirst. It's here the family's broken. And it's here the lonely say that the heart has got to open in a fundamental way. Democracy is coming to the USA.
And hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and I was just speaking then with Michelle Krauss, who's the CEO of Digital Campaigns. And she's made clear that the technology is available, and certainly better technology will be available to have accurate, transparent, and foolproof voting in this country, along with exit polls. And we will see whether or not we have exit polls in this forthcoming election, because that is the only way that you can tell the difference between the intention and the execution of the votes. And it's worth reminding the audience again that in 2000, the exit polling awarded the state of Florida to Al Gore based upon the exit polls. And clearly the intention of the voters in that state were to elect Al Gore, but the execution, as we found out later, was sabotaged in a myriad of ways. And I thank Mark Maxwell, the engineer, Louis Vandenberg, the producer, and Carol Coote and Grant Gruber, the assistant producers. This program can be accessed at ianmasters.org, along with all previous ones.